Welcome to Theatre Voice. This is Heather Neal and I'm with Michael Pennington at the Gate Theatre's offices in Notting Hill. Michael Pennington's a classical actor of immense experience, of course, and in fact we've met twice before to record interviews for Theatre Voice to talk about Chekhov and Shakespeare. This time our subject is perhaps a less lovable character, Strindberg. Michael Pennington is playing Edgar, the army captain locked in a viscerally destructive marriage in Dances of Death, a new version of which by Howard Brenton is playing at the Gate Theatre. Well, thank you, Michael, for joining us. And you just told me that it was your birthday on Friday last week. This is a Monday and you were 70. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Not only being 70, but playing such an enormous and demanding role at this stage. So your career goes on and on. But let's talk first of all about how you inhabit this character, because he really is quite a destructive and manipulative person, isn't he? Although there's a lot of humour in the play as well, we should say.
Yes, it's supportive of a corrosively unhappy marriage, which has been unhappy for 30 years. And I think it very much is the prototype for plays like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the kind of terrible black comedy of two people who are tearing each other's guts out but also can't do without each other. And considering when it was written at the turn of the in about 1900, it was well ahead of its time, I think, in many ways, and absolutely explicit about their tensions in a way that perhaps Ibsen or another playwright would have been more discreet about. It's very naked, the emotion in it, and the hatred, if that's not too, in fact, it isn't too strong a word, between them. But of course, you know, one's behaviour as a citizen and one's attitudes as a citizen are different from one's attitudes as an actor. Of course, those sorts of characters are absolutely fascinating, because the first thing you ask is, why are they like that? Why is he constantly manipulating and scheming to disadvantage her? Why is he trying to humiliate her at every turn? There has to be a reason somewhere, whether you dig back into childhood or the circumstances of their meeting or what it is. So you have to play, obviously enough, the character from his own point of view. It's a part that actually has been proposed to me a few times in the past, and I've always backed away from it because I've rather felt that it was so unremitting and you couldn't really see the humanity in the characters. But I realised why I felt that. It was because I was reading old-fashioned translations of the play. And what I mean by old-fashioned translations of the play is anything that's more than about 10 years old, because I do think translations of classics in particular probably need to be redone every decade. And Howard Brenton has delivered a quite remarkable version of the two plays, because not everybody knows there is a second play, Dance of Death, which is rarely done, and compressed the 5 or 6 hours that would have taken to play the two plays together into one evening of 2.5 hours. So it's quite an act of compression. So probably to do with cutting and compressing, as well as a much racier, briefer, terser writing style, which one would expect from Brenton, has made the part more somehow easier to play, and also emphasised the comedy, which is a great deal.
But nevertheless, it does have its challenges, because you start at a very high level, don't you? There's no sort of easing us into this marriage. No. The minute we see you together with Linda Marlowe, we're into it. So do you have to get yourself ready beforehand? I mean, how do you start?
In certain ways, but not quite perhaps in the way that you think. I mean, you just have to be fit. He does a spectacular dance very early on, a very famous dance that, you know, since Olivier did it all those years ago, is in a way what you're judged for in the part, which is a bit unfair as it's only, you know, about 60 seconds long in a 2.5 hour play. But yes, it's extremely intense. Strindberg's construction is very peculiar, because the first scene in real time is about half an hour in length, maybe a little bit more, and is then followed by a series of really quite short scenes, episodes, almost snapshots.
It's almost filmic, isn't it?
It becomes filmic, yeah. But it's rather like a film that has a very long establishing single shot at the beginning, which, as we know, is unusual and very exciting when it happens. But it goes from real time, as I say, in the first 40 minutes or so, into this sort of snapshot, cinematic style, which gets more extreme the further the play goes on. Towards the end of part two, there's a scene which only has two lines in it. And we've done that, we've emphasised that by using lighting and sound and sharp snap blackouts and so on, rather than what Strindberg would have had to do, which is have people come on and off the stage, you know, exit so-and-so, enter somebody else, exit, enter, which is quite boring to watch. You know, we do have the advantage of technology to solve some of these quite dreary problems that the 19th century dramatists had to deal with.
Mm. And presumably you worked very, very closely with the director, Tom Littler.
Yeah, he proposed this to me last autumn. I don't know why I gave in so easily. He said, well, he said, think about it. We'll get Howard to do it. I think it was Howard Brenton's willingness to do it that fixed me. Mm. I thought, that's a very good idea. Knowing his temperament and his, of course, his class as a writer, I thought we're just in with a chance with this. And in fact, it's turned out to be a pleasure. I mean, and I mean a pleasure, because some of these grim plays are a real, for some reason, very pleasurable to do, I suppose.
Well, I was going to ask you if you feel you have to come down out of that character, I mean, to be yourself again. Is that difficult?
Maybe I'm old and jaded. No, I'm not jaded at all. But I don't know. I don't think so. I remember being in King Lear at Stratford with Judi Dench once, and she was playing Regan, perhaps even the worst of the two wicked sisters, as it were. And she spent her whole time knitting when she wasn't on. And we laughed and laughed and laughed throughout the play. And there's something about these very extreme plays that perhaps you have to have a sense of humour about them, or you'd simply go balmy. Mm. I mean, in rehearsal, of course, you explore the hinterland of it, the emotional hinterland of it. But when you come to do it, the job is to make the audience feel as wretched as you once felt in rehearsal and then walk away from it. That's our job, yeah. You know. You can't go through it every night in an extreme way. That's what technique is for. You have to be able to deliver it and provoke the emotions in the audience rather than necessarily fully experiencing them yourself.
Did you and Linda talk about how you might have had a phase when you were happy at one stage? Because clearly you were very strongly drawn together and have been stuck together, whether you wanted to or not. And in some, and she says at the end, love and hate, and they can't really be separated.
I think, and I hope this is true, there's quite a strong sexual feeling between them. I think people who've seen the play say there seems to be an invisible stage full of tendrils between you, even when you're detesting each other. They are absolutely bound together. And I think that clearly what Strindberg is saying, first of all, she's an actress. She was an actress. And he was a rather dashing young captain. And there's quite a lot about how they used to go dancing and dance the Alcazar Waltz in the American bar, the Copenhagen Hotel.
Yeah.
Yes, Tivoli Bar. And so that's emphasised. So he was once quite a catch. She was a promising young captain, and she was an actress. And, of course, actresses at that time were regarded as, you know, the lowest of the low, in a way. And so she did well for herself by marrying a young officer. Unfortunately, he then got no further promotion. So he's at retirement age, having never become anything but a captain, certainly not a major. So he's desperately disappointed in the way that, for instance, Iago and Othello is desperately disappointed professionally, and that's part of the problem. He blames her for that. She blames him for not keeping her in the style to which she thought she would become accustomed. Mm. So they're mutually recriminating about things that actually aren't the other person's fault at all. They're projections of the person's own sense of failure, and that's, as we know, what often happens in you know,
well,
relationships.
Well, they've made it very hard for their daughter Judith to stay with them. It's obviously very uncomfortable to be at home at all. But when Kurt comes in, they then have an audience. Is that important, that they kind of need to play to somebody else?
It's what Albion, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, calls the game of getting the guests. You know, heaven help anybody who comes to dinner and gets between these two, because suddenly they become a team, a destructive team, turning on the interloper. In the case of Kurt in Dance of Death, it's a little more complex because there's quite strong hints that he and Alice have had some kind of brief affair at some point, probably right at the beginning of Alice's marriage, and that's a grievance. It's not spelt out by Strindberg, but it's there to play if you want to play, and I think it fairly clearly is. And certainly an affair, some form of sexual relationship develops during the course of the play between Alice and Kurt, so it's repeated.
Yeah.
So the tension, as soon as he comes on, the sense of a backstory is something that an audience very quickly picks up on and understands. They think, oh, we're in a triangle here, and there's a story here that probably has to do with just what I've described. So at least you've got some narrative to bite on there. Before then, and at other times in the play, there's a lot of mood music in it, in a sense. And because if you add to their relationship where they are, which is some rocky island, which is essentially a leper colony, it's a quarantine island off the Swedish coast where they would have sent smallpox victims and so on, and in order they didn't infect the rest of the population. So it's a small military garrison on a a sort of devil's island. I mean, a desperately dreary and suicidal place to be posted for anybody, for a soldier, for anybody, and they're living there. Think of the evenings, the long winter evenings, there with nothing to do, a wife or husband you detest, nothing to do but play a little cards, which, you know, they always quarrel over, nothing much to eat because they're broke, the maids are all leaving the service. I mean, you've got the perfect recipe of kind of suicidal situation between them. So that's the thing, that the circumstances have been unkind to them. Of course, they've also contributed to their own disaster.
Yes. And then it goes on to the next generation because Edgar is not satisfied simply with trying to control his own generation. It goes into his daughter's and her interest in Kurt's son, which he tries to
destroy.
Sabotage,
yes.
This time he doesn't quite succeed.
Well, it cost him his life, in fact.
Yes.
The interest of the second play is really the inheritance for the, as you say, their daughter and Kurt's son, and to what extent the genes, with a G, have been passed on. Because the daughter, Judith, certainly starts as a cruel girl. That she does finally fall in love and breaks this vicious circle of destructiveness by going with her heart and running away with Alan, which, in fact, the shock of which destroys the captain, has a stroke and dies. So good does prevail in the end. But that's the claim for the reason for doing the second play, is to get that. Edgar continues on his campaign of destroying Kurt, which is what motivated him almost from the beginning of the play, as Kurt has done well by the second half of the play. And Edgar, he's got a wonderful house on the good side of the island, whereas the captain is still on the old bad side of the island. And he manipulates Kurt with a bit of insider dealing, tempts him into an investment, which destroys him, and so on and so on.
And this is Christopher Ravenscroft.
Christopher Ravenscroft, playing, absolutely, yeah. Yes, absolutely. And also separates him, Kurt, from his son, Alan, whom the captain manages to get reposted in the farthest north of Lapland to get rid of him. So his triumph is complete, but then what happens is that he loses his daughter, as I've said, and the daughter runs away, and that breaks what's left of his heart.
Yes. Yes, she seems to be his daughter, which in a sense she is, because perhaps that's where her strength comes from in the end, to break it.
Yes, I think the mother and the father fight over the daughter, and both of them want to control her in their different ways. There's a sense in which the mother is also trying to control the daughter, and she, you know, it's a terrible inheritance for her. And it looks as if she's going to be as destructive as, well, a combination of the two of them. But in the end, she breaks out of it, and, you know, a little flicker of light appears at the end of this very deep, dark tunnel.
Well, Strindberg was what? He was only about 52 or something when he wrote this. Was he 51, 52, something like that?
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, one of the fascinations, I've never done a Strindberg before, and one of the fascinations is to read, you know, the recent biography of him by Suprilo. Yeah. And what I hadn't realised, of course, is that he was, as a young man, the most enchanting, attractive, witty, funny. He sounds a bit like Chekhov, curiously enough. We have an image of Strindberg as this misogynist and you know, brooding figure. But I think the first 20 years of his life, you know, he was a real charmer, and the disappointment in his life would have been that Miss Julie, which was one of his earliest plays, was never performed until the end of his life because it was considered far too bold for the time. Sweden at the time was very backward in terms of...
And he was really ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Way ahead of his time in two ways. I mean, he, at a certain point in his life, wrote a marvellous feminist manifesto, something that Jermaine Greer might write now.
I know, that's extraordinary. Yeah. I didn't realise that until recently. I mean, it's because one always has just assumed that, you know, a woman should not go near Strindberg.
No, it's quite untrue of him then. I mean, it was impeccable, that the manifesto, women should have rights, they should have separate room, they should have, you know, half that property if they divorced, all those things. It caused him to be tried for blasphemy, of all things, by the Swedish court, and he was amazed to find that the very small feminist movement in Sweden that was just beginning at that time refused to have anything to do with him. I'm afraid because he was a man, and they weren't welcoming him into the movement, which was really rather short-sighted of them. He got away with it, but at that very moment, his wife, an actress called Siri, ran away with another woman. So a sort of tilt happened in him, not unsurprisingly. And I think the sort of late Strindberg, the misogynist, the destructive man who denounced his friends in the press and insulted everybody and was a sort of public liability, also drank a lot. That's the image we have of him, but it really belongs to the second half of his life.
Well, he was married three times, though, right. and generally unhappily, because there were already problems in the marriage with Siri, weren't there, before she ran away?
There were.
And I mean, how much is this play, do you think, drawing on that?
Deeply.
And he's supposed to have stayed with his sister, was it
just
before?
Yeah, it was provoked by, I think I have this right, his sister and brother-in-law, he went to stay with them and observed their marriage at close quarters, which was apparently appalling, went home and wrote The Dance of Death, sent it to them as a matter of interest, whereupon the husband threw it on the fire and never spoke to him again, because whatever state their marriage was in, it perhaps wasn't quite as bad as Alison Edgar in the play. So he ruthlessly used his family and acquaintances for this, but then that's what writers do, after all. He was obviously a very difficult man in relationships, and I think the play is full of Strindberg. I think the captain is full of Strindberg, though he probably wasn't as awful as the captain.
Mm. But Strindberg himself was vilified for having abandoned his children, wasn't he? And
Kurt keeps part in the play. That's perfectly true.
Yes.
But also he had a wretched child. He had a wretched father. He was the sort of child who got locked in the coal house, you know.
Mm.
And I have a feeling, and I could be wrong, but I think his father ran a quarantine station very much as Edgar does in the play.
Mm.
I think that's right. I shouldn't swear to it. So I think he draws on a lot of himself for Edgar and then makes it worse, probably.
And his mother died when he was only
that's
about
right.
13, too.
That's right, lack of female presence in his life. So in a quite subtle but deep way, I think it's autobiographical.
Yes. Yes, well, he said that he drew on his life, didn't he?
Yeah. I love him. I think he's fascinating because he is... One of the things that's truly fascinating about him was that the play eventually was performed in... He set up a little theatre. called the Little Theatre. Mm-hmm. Late in his life, he raised a lot of money and organised his theatre in which the repertoire was exclusively all his plays, and he did write an awful lot that weren't done elsewhere. And The Dance of Death was one of them. And he was, though the writer and ipso facto director, he was very shy to criticise the actors to their faces and didn't like confronting them about anything, so he used to write them letters after the performances every night, which therefore have survived and can now be read. And what emerges is this absolutely contemporary theatre man. He talks to the actors in his letters exactly as a modern director would talk to me. Mm. He talks completely modern language. He said, why do you take that pause? Why do you look at the audience when you should be looking at the other actor? Why are you doing that unnecessary thing? Very, very modern in his thinking. And that in itself is very interesting, plus the fact that this play, of all plays, would have been done originally in a theatre very much the size of the Gate where we're doing it now, not in a big theatre, as it so often is done, where the claustrophobia for the audience, if the play was halfway good, would have been
really
extreme.
It does fit well, I think.
Yeah, and on a good night with us, you know, some story of the Times critic, I think it was, or one of the critics, chewing a hole in their raincoat while they watched the play. I like that. I find it a bit hard to believe. But,
yeah,
you know,
well, it's Libby Purvis. She does actually say in her review
that
she did.
Yes, well, I'm delighted to have we've connected because that's what we're after.
Yeah.
But there is, I should emphasise, there is an impishness in The Captain and there is a comedy in the play which some audiences enjoy and some audiences have no time for. It's quite interesting. It's very extreme variation.
Mm.
Some audiences come into it and they just think this is too terrible for words. Others enjoy the kind of Richard III-ish.
One does get the sense that it's been a game that's gone on for 30 years.
It's a ritual.
And it's, yes, exactly, a ritual. And not pleasant for the participants, but still something which... It is also their distraction, though, isn't it?
Yes, they have nothing else to do except tripping each other up and setting booby traps for each other. He's better at it than she is. But he's sort of endlessly manipulative. Richard III is a good example.
Yeah.
And he has the same glee in his ghastly manoeuvrings as Richard does. Of course, Strindberg doesn't quite give him what Shakespeare gives Richard, which is the moment at the end when, you know, everything falls away and he's just this helpless man in a tent having nightmares.
Mm.
You don't quite get that with Strindberg.
No, but the last line we hear that he has spoken is that he forgives them. They
so
know
funny.
Not what they do.
So
a line
yeah,
of
Jesus
Christ's
Christ.
Line.
Yeah, I know, it's so marvelous.
And, well, so... do we understand from that he actually doesn't know himself, or he does know himself so well that he's still going to get a jab at them as he dies?
Yeah, and beyond the grave, he's sort of he's sort of shafted them again, really. You know, that's what I take it as. I think it's a wonderful thing. You know, your last lines of a quote from Christ the Redeemer that they'll never escape from. I also like the fact that many times in the play, in Howard's version, he says improbably and unexpectedly, "Don't be angry with me." He says it three or four times, including the very last line he has almost, I think. And you think, what does that mean? Don't be angry with me. There's some, you know, Freudian thing that goes on. There's something in him which is a small child. That's the, in my view, the what's interesting about the part. He's a big baby, a big destructive baby. And that obviously is very interesting to play. If you've just got someone who's beyond measure unspeakable, then you've only got a limited form of entertainment. But that's what we started by saying. Why is he like he is? It's something to do with the child inside him, destructive child inside him, throwing his toys out of the cot all the time.
And you can't really blame them in the end, can you, for being like that?
Yeah, you have to lock him in his room till he calms down, gets his toys back and starts playing again. I don't know that I want to play it for a year, put it that way. But it is fascinating because of his lack of sentiment too.
I shouldn't ask you this, I suppose. I wondered if there was any chance of it moving anywhere else.
Oh, I don't think so. I think it's a tricky proposition, this.
Mm. It's not really West End.
Not West End at all, especially in a way at the moment. Perhaps it would never have been, though it has been done in the West End. Mm. And where would we go from here? You know, I doubt it. I may be surprised, but I doubt it. It's a tough proposition for everybody. It's not tough to put on, but it's in terms of money, but it's a tough... I think it was a tough thing to sell, even with the best reviews in the world.
Yes. There has been one fairly recently, hasn't there? Trafalgar Studios, I think.
Yeah, at Christmas time. It's very, very interesting to see. Colin McPherson did a very good version of it, which indeed I went to see because I was so curious about the play. I knew I was going to do it, and I went to see it, and I admired it very much. It's all to do with the kind of comedy you get out of it. Mm. And you've got to be careful the comedy isn't too jaunty, so it's not... like, you know, an average show on television about henpecked husbands and nagging wives. It's deeper than that and tenser. At the same time, it is funny. And you flag up the first laugh, as you might say, in the first page, and you either give the audience permission to laugh at it and enjoy it, or you scare them.
Yes.
It's quite interesting to see. There's a good, you know, misanthropic joke on the first page, and if it goes down well, we know what we're in for.
And it varies from night to night.
Absolutely. Mm. More extremely almost than anything I remember. Mm. It may depend on what's happening in the audience's lives as to what they think of this, but it's very extreme variation. It's nothing to do with us, really. It's to do with how people take it. That's some people just are appalled by this kind of material, and other people find a cruel glee in it.
At bottom, one of the things it's about is mortality, isn't it? It's about how long we've got and how we can waste the time. And
He says quite correctly early on, the captain, he says, well, we must make use of the time we have left before it's all over. Exactly. What he means is how much mischief we can get up to, or how much mischief I can get up to at your expense. It's a perfectly good sentiment. And he, you know, she keeps telling him, the doctor says he's going to die. He says, I've got 20 more years. He obviously is in a bit of trouble with his heart or his circulation. There's sort of a series of about 6 or 7 mini-strokes in the course of the evening that he has. We would call them mini-strokes, I think. And so his health is not good. And he's a drinker, big drinker. So he's on the edge.
And smoker.
And smoker, yeah. Mm. He's very much on the edge and terrified. Terrified of death, absolutely terrified. Well, who isn't? But terrified of in what form it's going to come. Mm. So there you've got something human.
So that the dance he does is sort of determination not to give in.
Absolutely. It's a savage, wild Hungarian folk dance that he does.
Which would take anyone quite a bit of energy if it went on for very long at all.
Believe me. Believe me, it does. And of course, what he's doing in that particular context, Kurt has just arrived. There's immediately a little flicker of something between Kurt and Alice. He goes out on duty to inspect the guards. And actually what it is, it's the male display. He's frightening off the lover. Mm. He's Bluebeard guarding the fair maiden and frightening off the intruder. It's a keep-off dance. Big male posturing dance.
How did you work out what to do for the dance, didn't you?
Worked out what he was doing in the story, which essentially is what we're just saying.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's what you've got to do, is you've got to work out what it's for, why he's put it there. And then...
So it's got to be spectacular.
It's got to be fierce. Mm. wild and liberating in a strange way. Mm. And indeed, in a funny way, liberating for the audience, because that's what dance does. And dance just lifts you off into something else, even momentarily, that language can't do, of course, as all music does. And then you start looking on YouTube at all the Hungarian village dancers, and you see, well, all they do is they clap and they stamp, but in such syncopated, brilliant patterns that you just despair. And then you find yourself a good choreographer, which I did, Quinny Sachs, who's particularly good, though, you know, absolutely paid up, an expert choreographer, is particularly good at teaching, you know, nervous actors how to do this stuff. And you get a repertoire of steps, and then you work them out, and then you practice them until they're in the bone, as a dancer would. But that's what it's there for. It's to scare.
And did you say it's, what, 60 seconds?
Oh, I would think so. I've not timed it. It feels like
a... I mean, it's such a... One does focus on it so much, it feels that it must be longer than that when
it. It can't be more than a minute. Can't be more than a minute, I don't think. But it's one of those moments, you know. And everyone told me that, you know, Olivier did this spectacular dance. I got hold of a DVD of it and watched it. Actually, didn't try very hard at all. I must say, you know, it's the least important thing in his performance, though it was good. But I wanted to make a feature of it because it has a sort of ritual impact. But you must be telling the story. You must know why you're doing it, why you're doing it in that particular way, and who you're giving a message to, which, you know, that's really what it's for. But of course, you know, it causes him to collapse.
Yes.
And his downhill slide into, you know, ischemic attacks begins then.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned one of the reviewers who gave you a very good review, of course. But have you read them? Do you know?
I'm becoming a bit more relaxed about this sort of thing. Yeah. And I know what the critical reception has been. Yeah. It's been largely, with barely a dissenting voice, very, very good indeed.
Yes, very good indeed. But there was one two-star review, I think, mainly taking, because the person didn't like Strindberg rather than anything else, which seemed a bit odd. But anyway, it's the way it divided people, although mostly, as you say, it's been very favourable. Mm. But, I mean, that is quite rare, I think, to have reviews from 2 to 5 stars, because there was a 5-star one.
Yes, there was. It to some extent, the night you do it, you know... The first night went extremely well. You know, we're professionals, we're doing the same performance. Yeah. It's better with a full house than a half-empty one. Yeah. And there's always a lull with theatres like this that can't afford to do a lot of advertising. You're completely dependent on word of mouth and reviews, and that takes a week or so to travel, generally speaking. There's not a rush on the box office the next day, ever. And, you know, you can't take pounds in the newspapers because they cost far too much money. So we're very review-dependent. You're very dependent on, you know, the first night, playing to a full audience that gets it. And we did well that night, I have to say. It was a very good night. But I think a lot of it, as you say, is to do with reaction to the play. It's such a provocative thing. He's so cavalier, Strindberg, about certain things to do with narrative and plot, which is very confused until you tidy it up. He didn't give a damn, really, about narrative logic. Mm. He was only interested in what the unpredictable behaviour of people. This is what he means, it's psychology. And, you know, you have to... work a bit like Shakespeare, actually. I have to say, you have to rationalize details of the story because it keeps changing track and contradicting itself. In fact, he wasn't interested, he was interested. You know, there's a reason why writers like Beckett, Pinter, Osborne loved Strindberg and would quote Strindberg as a major influence, because he was an experimenter. There's a scene in this play when we do a shorter version of it where I think for 3 or 4 pages the captain destroys the house, the room that you've been looking at. I mean, there's not a single line, it's just a series of stage directions. He throws his cigars out of the window, he breaks mirrors, he does this, he burns things. That was a very bold thing to write. Mm. You know, there's no dialogue, there's no monologue. He just does a series of rather erratic, destructive, distressed things. And I just think it doesn't sound like an experiment now, but I think at his time it would have been a very unusual thing to write. And there are little echoes of Godot, or rather Godot in some ways echoes some of Strindberg. So I think he was very advanced. He's sort of maddening. He also doesn't allow you, you know, certain traditional comforts, like feeling sorry for them much, these two characters. Mm. These sorts of characters, you know, I suppose Shakespeare conditions you to this. Richard III has his comeuppance in the tent, as we said earlier. You know, the villain sees the error of his ways and we all feel good about that. Or we see how miserable they are underneath their cruelty and we all feel good about that.
Well, there's some redemption at the end, usually, isn't there?
Usually, but there's not much in this. Not much.
Not in this. No,
he doesn't care. He would call that sentimental,
yes.
I think, Strindberg. Yeah. I think what he's saying is very much what Shakespeare was saying with Iago. The fact that Iago and Othello doesn't get executed or shot, or anything. He survives in a funny way.
I bleed, sir, but not killed.
If he was completely indestructible.
Yes.
Or you think of the Coen brothers from No Country for Old Men, when the Bardem character is completely indestructible. They blow him up and he keeps walking.
Yeah.
What he's saying is there's a form of evil that people can generate which you can't really destroy except, you know, by cutting them in half.
And Antonio in The Tempest, who
absolutely
doesn't speak.
So he's very unsentimental about this. There's not a moment when the captain says, oh, I forgive me. Well, he does, except he does it with Christ's words as a sort of taunt. So, you know, I think that discomforts people.
Yes.
They think, why are we watching this?
Yes, also, you start by thinking, well, of course I'm going to feel sympathy for Alice, and then you think, oh, how could she do?
Terrible.
I mean, well, she's just as bad as he is, and then you push back and forth.
Much worse. I have a stroke. I ask her for a glass of water, and she has a good drink of water herself.
Oh, yes.
She gives it. You know, she's much worse than I am. But you could watch and think, why am I watching this?
Yeah.
There was one reviewer rather tastefully called it, it's like watching botched surgery. Actually, it's not like watching botched surgery. It's like watching the growth of an absolutely unattributable, incurable cancer. You know, there are things we can't do anything about. And this, what they've got into, there's a good point when the captain says, rather casually, well, Kurt is weak, but evil is strong. As if indeed he knew that they had created something evil, like the Macbeths. You know, that they've somehow enter the evil in a way that they'll never get out of. And that's what he's after. But it's not everyone's cup of tea on a Friday night, that's for sure.
And one does wonder about Strindberg's own state of mind. I mean, but, you know, that isn't necessarily relevant to our response to his play, because it still speaks to us.
But you see, you wouldn't say that about Ibsen, would you? You say, well, Ibsen, you turned his hand to all these things.
Yes.
And of course, he had beliefs about the emancipation of women and about social justice and so on. But, you know, Strindberg, you sort of sense him stalking through his own plays.
You do.
You know, they seem quite confessional in a way. Certainly this one.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other thing about him is unbelievably prolific. I can't quote you the numbers, but hundreds of plays he wrote, hundreds of novellas, hundreds of essays. He never stopped
writing.
Yes,
and he was a painter, too.
And he was a painter.
Yeah.
How did he find time to drink any absinthe? You know, or have these marriages, or have breakdowns, or live that life in Berlin that he did.
And he had five children, I think, as well.
Yes, he messed all that up, I think.
Three different mothers, yeah.
Yes, he did. So he's a very interesting character. Mm-hmm. And you know, don't you, that Ibsen, in his study in Oslo, had a big picture, and you can still see it, of Strindberg above his desk. Not because he liked Strindberg, he detested Strindberg and felt very threatened by him, was very jealous of him. But he said having Strindberg's picture on the wall made him work harder in order to compete with Strindberg. He'd shake his fist at Strindberg and start writing Ghosts, you know, something else. He was the stimulus that Ibsen needed to write his masterpieces. So he served that. But
he
actually half created Ibsen's masterpieces as well.
Well, thank you, Michael. And I know you've got to get ready for Edgar again fairly shortly. So thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome.